Are you concerned about equality and fair treatment for African Americans? Do you believe in a future where our communities are safe from both crime and over-policing? President Biden's administration is making major decisions, and we need your voice to be heard. The proposed ban on menthol cigarettes is in its final stages of approval, and Black and brown law enforcement executives have said it could have dire, unintended consequences for African Americans. The clock is ticking. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414 and ask him to stop this proposed menthol rule. The ban on menthol could lead to an illicit market and increased crime in our communities. Call President Biden and demand that he halt the ban on menthol until there's a review of the investigative findings. Let's make sure that over-policing and racial profiling come to an end. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414. Tell him to stop targeting African Americans with a menthol ban. Time is running out. This message is paid for by Alliance for Fair and Equitable Policy.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of Saga 960 AM or its management.
Richard! Richard!
Oh, are we on?
Welcome to the Richard Serrett Show on News Talk Saga 960 AM.
Welcome to Radio Free Canada, news, notes, and opinions from the underground. This program is pre-recorded. Monday's program will also be pre-recorded. I'll be flying home Tuesday. So on Tuesday, we have a special program for you, a two-hour special on human trafficking in Canada. You don't want to miss that. Wednesday will likely be a best of the Richard Serrett Show because I'll likely be sawing some logs most of Wednesday, recovering from jet lag. Thursday, back to live programming, and I'm looking forward to getting back into my home studio. Here's what we have for you today. A U.S. government watchdog has sued the federal government in the U.S. on behalf of OpenTheBooks.com in order to obtain access to Dr. Anthony Fauci's financial disclosure records, as well as royalties paid to employees of the National Institutes of Health. Fauci, of course, has been criticized for the fact that the American government has contributed financially to research that included work on gain of function, which is intended to take threats like coronavirus and make them worse. He's repeatedly denied that, but documents from the NIH show that, in fact, it did happen. Andrew Angievsky is the CEO and founder of OpenTheBooks.com. He's seeking the release of all of Fauci's employment contracts since he was hired as director of the NIH and the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases. He's also seeking any confidentiality documents, conflict documents, economic interest disclosure documents, and also a current job description and economic interest disclosure documents pertaining to calendar year 2020 to the present, as well as a complete list or database of all personal royalties paid to current and former NIH employees for work done while they were federally employed. Wow. Andrew Angievsky, again, CEO and founder of OpenTheBooks.com, will be here shortly. I think we could use someone like Andrew Angievsky up here in Canada. What do you think? Matt Cullen, the voice of the Mississauga Steelheads, heard exclusively here on News Talk Saga 960, will be here this hour to talk some hockey. Another huge win for the Leafs. And some more OT heroics from William Nylander last night as the Buds rallied to beat the Stanley Cup champs Tampa Bay Lightning. And an OT win for the Steelheads as well the other night with Captain Ethan Del Mastro scoring the winner for a 3-2 win over the Kingston Frontenacs. So much to discuss with Matt Cullen. It's Friday. That means a visit from the Lim Riddler. He'll be here just before the news at 5 with this week's Lim Riddle Clues and your chance to win a pair of tickets to the Mississauga Steelheads' next home game, happening this Sunday, November 7th, 2 p.m., at the Paramount Fine Food Center. This is an exciting young team, so come on out and watch some future NHL stars with the return of OHL hockey. And to get your Mississauga Steelheads tickets, visit the Paramount Fine Food Center box office or call 905-502-7788. 905-502-7788. Coming up in hour two, I'll speak with Jonathan Emord, one of America's foremost experts on constitutional and administrative law. Jonathan has practiced before the federal courts and agencies for 35 years. He's been with us before on the program, but I've set aside the entire second hour today to dive a little deeper In his book, The Authoritarians, Jonathan reveals the untold story and largely hidden practices of authoritarians who've worked inside the U.S. government to undermine the Constitution and override rights protections since the earliest days of the progressive era.
Hypocrite. You're a hypocrite.
Hypocrisy much?
I haven't done a Hypocrisy Much segment in quite a while, although there's certainly no shortage of it these days. I've been going after the hospitals in Ontario a lot lately, and deservedly so. They come cap in hand, complaining about funding shortages. They gouge us with exorbitant parking fees. And now, despite the Ford government's announcement that they will not mandate healthcare employees to get the vaccine, the hospitals are going ahead anyway and coercing nurses. Nurses who were just heroes a few months ago, now they're being fired if they refuse to disclose their vaccine status or refuse to get vaxxed. But wait, it gets worse. Yesterday, I mentioned that a group of hospitals in Ontario have formed an alliance. I call it an alliance of evil. And they've announced that anyone wishing to visit a patient or volunteer at the hospital to assist patients must be vaccinated. Now imagine having a parent in hospital. Maybe that parent is dying, and perhaps these parents have decided that their healthy child should not be vaccinated against COVID, which in my opinion would be the correct decision. That child then would be denied the opportunity to visit their dying parent. This is appallingly bad policy. And here we have a truly heartbreaking story. A young woman on Twitter who goes by the handle The Resolutist. Her tweet includes a picture of her very elderly parents who appear to be well into their 80s. They're embracing. And The Resolutist writes, "These are my parents. They've been married for more than 50 years. On the day my mom was diagnosed with cancer and kidney failure, the hospital administration would not allow my father and me to see her. The reason? We're COVID-19 unvaccinated. My mother is also COVID-19 unvaccinated. My mother and father and I are all COVID-19 negative. On the day my mom was diagnosed, the security guard at the hospital, who had castigated me 48 hours earlier for not having a QR code when I brought my dad to the emergency room with heart troubles, made sure to tell the secretary not to allow my father and me to visit my mother. I'll never forget the heartless actions of that security guard, nor will I forget his face and his cruel eyes. On the day we found out about my mom's cancer, I brought my father back to the emergency room, completely distressed. At the hospital checkpoint, there were now four security guards, not one, but four, who were there to make sure my COVID-negative 83-year-old father did not visit my COVID-negative 81-year-old mother, who was just told she has cancer. I urgently emailed the Prime Minister of Canada and the Minister of Health in Quebec, pleading for compassionate measures to allow my two octogenarian parents, who have been inseparable for over 50 years, to see each other during this extremely traumatic time. I never received an answer. She continues, "Finding out that my mom has cancer is traumatic. The fact that the hospital kept my father and my mother separated for almost 2 weeks under the guise of public health is monstrous." Yes, monstrous. That is exactly the correct word. This is monstrous behavior. And I wish I knew which hospital in Quebec this was so that I could call them out. The administrative staff at this hospital should be deeply ashamed of themselves. This is appallingly poor behavior. Resolutist ends the thread with these words, and I couldn't have said it better myself. Canada is no longer a country. It's a tyrannical biomedical regime. This really is enough. I'd say it's the final straw. This should be the final straw, but it won't be, and it isn't. But I truly cannot find the words to adequately describe my utter disgust and disdain and contempt for these hospital administrators. The people who would do such a thing, I can't knowingly coexist with such people. We need to build a parallel society. We need to build our own schools and, yes, even our own hospitals. Yes, it is possible. This is the way forward. These are not the actions of someone with even a modicum of compassion or empathy. These are people with sick, callous, and hardened hearts, and they have no business being in healthcare.
You either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Heroes and villains.
All right, I wanted to give you something uplifting. to know that somewhere out there, there are a few good politicians. This is a member of the European Parliament, or MEP, Christine Anderson. She's from Germany, standing up against vaccine mandates. Enjoy.
But it is not the goal that renders a system oppressive. It is always the methods by which the goal is pursued. Whenever a government claims to have the people's interest at heart, you need to think again. In the entire history of mankind, there has never been a political elite sincerely concerned about the well-being of regular people. What makes any of us think that it is different now? If the Age of Enlightenment has brought forth anything, then certainly this. Never take anything any government tells you at face value. Always question everything any government does or does not do. Always look for ulterior motives and always ask, cui bono, who benefits? Whenever a political elite pushes an agenda this hard and resorts to extortion and manipulation to get their way, you can almost always be sure your benefit is definitely not what they had at heart. As far as I'm concerned, I will not be vaccinated with anything that has not been properly vetted and tested and has shown no sound scientific evidence that the benefits outweigh the disease itself and possible long-term side effects, which to this day we don't know anything about. I will not be reduced to a mere guinea pig by getting vaccinated with an experimental drug. And I will most assuredly not get vaccinated because my government tells me to and promises in return I will be granted freedom. Let's be clear about one thing. No one grants me freedom, for I am a free person. So I dare the European Commission and the German government. Throw me in jail, lock me up and throw away the key for all I care. But you will never be able to coerce me into being vaccinated if I, the free citizen that I am, choose not to be vaccinated.
That's today's hero, German member of the European Parliament, Christine Anderson. No villains today. Well, I suppose the administrators of that hospital I mentioned earlier, they're truly villains. Okay, Andrew Angievsky, the CEO and founder of OpenTheBooks.com, is here next to discuss his efforts to obtain financial records for Dr. Anthony Mengele, Fauci. That conversation in 3 minutes.
We're back as the Richard Serrett Show continues on News Talk, Saga 960 AM.
A government watchdog has sued the federal government on behalf of OpenTheBooks.com to obtain access to Dr. Anthony Fauci's financial disclosure records. Adam Angievsky is founder and CEO of OpenTheBooks.com. Adam, welcome. How are you?
Great to be on the program, Richard. Thank you for your interest in our work.
Tell us a little bit about OpenTheBooks.com.
So at OpenTheBooks.com, our mission is quite simply summarized as every dime online in real time. And to that end, last year, we did something pretty unique. We filed 40,500 Freedom of Information Act requests on nearly every single substantial government body across the United States. So that's at the federal level, the state level, and the local level. And we were successful capturing nearly every single public employee's salary and pension record, for example. And we've got, you know, the federal checkbook, the line-by-line vendor spending all the way back to the year 2001. And we do have the state checkbooks in 49 out of 50 states. We don't have California, but we're suing them. And we're in front of a Sacramento state court judge on November 19th in summary judgment. And we expect to win there as well and crack open the checkbook in California in the Golden State for the first time.
So you asked Judicial Watch, which is a government watchdog, to sue the federal government to obtain Dr. Fauci's financial disclosure records. He's a public employee. Shouldn't those be available to anyone at any time? Why would you have to sue to get those?
Well, it shouldn't take a subpoena or a lawsuit to be able to get Fauci's basic employment documents. So here's what we asked for. And to put this in a little bit of context, back in January of this year, we were the organization, our auditors at OpenTheBooks.com, that looked at our federal employment data, salary data, and found that Dr. Anthony Fauci was the number one most highly compensated federal employee. So he out-earned everybody, the president, four-star generals in the United States military, 4.3 million of his colleagues within the federal agencies and the post office, Department of Defense. And so many people had a question as to how this scientist at a sub-agency of a sub-agency, you know, there's the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the National Institutes of Health, and then underneath that is Fauci's agency. So how can this guy out-earn everybody? And so we had questions too, and we filed this Freedom of Information Act request with the National Institutes of Health, and we wanted to know, we wanted copies of Anthony Fauci's employment contract. And what's important is all additions, amendments, and changes to that contract over the years. We wanted a copy of his job description, and we wanted a copy of his conflict of interest disclosures and his financial disclosures. Now, all of this is legal paperwork subject to sunshine, and we wanted to see it. And they slow walked it, and they produced hardly any of it. And so last week we got serious, we partnered with Judicial Watch, and we sued them.
So what the fact that you have to sue to get disclosure suggests what? That he's hiding something?
Well, they're acting like they have a lot to hide. So Richard, they did disclose a small portion of some old records. And we took a look at those. We made national news last week because we found out the reason why Fauci is the most highly paid. And it started in 2004 with a memo during the George W. Bush administration. And the memo specifically lays out the reason he makes the most money. Fauci back in 2004 got a permanent pay adjustment. And the reason for that permanent pay adjustment that continues to this day is because he was tip of the spear on bioterrorism. In other words, Richard, Dr. Fauci was paid to prevent the next pandemic starting in 2004.
He's paid to prevent it. How's he doing so far?
Well, the real question out there, hopefully it'll be answered over the next month, couple of months, is whether the firemen became the arsonists. Because as what's coming to light, even as exposed by the Washington Post, Fauci was funding, in contravention of two presidents, Obama and Trump, very controversial, very dangerous experiments. These experiments are called gain-of-function experiments. And the Washington Post outlined since 2012 through 2020 that Fauci and his agency funded 17 of those experiments for over $40 million. And now critics have always said that these experiments are very dangerous because if there's a lab leak or if the virus that they soup up and they try to make this virus technologically able to jump from bats or animals to humans, and then in the lab they try to come up with the vaccine to solve the pandemic that they've created in their lab, this is very dangerous. And the critics always said, if that virus jumps outside the lab on a leak, we've got a problem. Or if it gets handed off to nefarious actors, bad actors, we have a problem.
All right, Adam, we'll take a quick timeout. We'll come back and discuss further. Adam Andrzejewski, CEO, founder of OpenTheBooks.com. Back with more in 3 minutes. Don't go away.
Let's get back at it on Newstalk Saga 960 AM. It's the Richard Serrett Show.
Adam Andrzejewski stays with us, CEO, founder of OpenTheBooks.com. They have asked a government watchdog, Judicial Watch, to sue the federal government to obtain access to Dr. Fauci's financial disclosure records. One of the documents you asked for was his current job description. On the face of it, that seems like a rather mundane sounding document. Don't we already know what his job description is? Why are you looking for that document specifically?
Well, this is very important because it specifically would outline his duties and responsibilities. And I want to just put one key point out there. So we know that the National Institutes of Health, currently, they employ, according to our data captured at OpenTheBooks.com, they employ 80 public relations officers. Yet everybody, since the pandemic started, has been treated to Anthony Fauci doing public affairs, public relations, on the pandemic. And so we want to know if public affairs is in his job description. There is a little known law called the Gillette Amendment that dates back to 1913, and it expressly bars the publicity man, the bureaucrat that gets out there and does propaganda and public affairs and PR campaigns. You can't do that. So we want to see if PR and public affairs is actually in Dr. Anthony Fauci's job description after 400 of these events and the agency itself employing 80 PR specialists.
All right, that's fascinating. I wasn't aware of that. And what about the conflict of interest documents? What are you hoping, what do you think you might potentially uncover there?
So we want to know if Dr. Anthony Fauci is receiving royalties from pharmaceutical companies. Over at the National Institutes of Health, on current employees and employees that used to work at NIH, there's up to 1,000 employees or former employees receiving royalties from companies. And this is perfectly legal. However, we want to know if Dr. Anthony Fauci has any conflicts of interest on this. And look, these are basic documents he has to file every single year. We want a copy of that, and we're serious about obtaining it.
So again, let's talk about this database of all royalties paid. Royalties for what? Drug patents?
Yes. So researchers at NIH, they contribute alongside pharmaceutical companies. For instance, alongside Moderna on the development of the COVID vaccine, you had researchers in Fauci's agency working with Moderna on developing that vaccine as right away when that pandemic hit in March of 2020. If you Google, you'll come up with news articles that Fauci's agency at the National Allergies and Infectious Diseases Agency, they were working with Moderna to develop the vaccine. There's legal standards then as to whether those individuals working for the federal government can be compensated on royalties from the pharmaceutical company. Now, this database, according to agency policy, is supposed to be on their website.
Are you concerned about equality and fair treatment for African Americans? Do you believe in a future where our communities are safe from both crime and over-policing? President Biden's administration is making major decisions, and we need your voice to be heard. The proposed ban on menthol cigarettes is in its final stages of approval, and Black and brown law enforcement executives have said it could have dire unintended consequences for African Americans. The clock is ticking. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414 and ask him to stop this proposed menthol rule. The ban on menthol could lead to an illicit market and increased crime in our communities. Call President Biden and demand that he halt the ban on menthol until there's a review of the investigative findings. Let's make sure that over-policing and racial profiling come to an end. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414. Tell him to stop targeting African Americans with a menthol ban. Time is running out. This message is paid for by Alliance for Fair and Equitable Policy.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly!
It's Superstart Battery Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Get up to a $25 gift card after rebate with the purchase of select Superstart batteries. Our professional parts people will test your old battery for free and recommend the right battery for your vehicle. For power, performance, and reliability, choose Superstart batteries only at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Since the middle 2000s, and we can find no evidence of it, so we filed a Freedom of Information Act request for it. When they didn't produce it, we sued them for it.
If it was to be discovered, and this is speculation, that Dr. Fauci is receiving royalties for a drug that could be used as a therapeutic for COVID, for example, and he is, let's say, promoting that particular drug over ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, et cetera, that would be a clear conflict of interest, would it not?
Well, all these things would invite ethical considerations. And so I don't want to speculate, Richard. I just want to see the documents. And unfortunately, we had to sue for them.
What's the next step, Adam? How difficult is it like a FOIA request?
Right. So that we started with the Freedom of Information Act request. And now when they didn't produce the database of royalties and Anthony Fauci's basic employment documents, we partnered with Judicial Watch. We filed that suit The agency's actually been served with the suit. So we're on record with them and with the court. And the next step next month is a hearing in front of a federal court judge.
And if the judge were to rule in your favor that they must release these documents, what would the timeline look like? How quickly would they have to disclose?
Well, I think it would be pretty much immediate. I think this thing gets this is a pretty cut and dried case. I don't think they can wiggle out of this one. There's a lot of precedent on all of these different points. And I think they have to produce the database of royalties. And I think they have to produce rapidly Dr. Anthony Fauci's employment documents. And look, we were very kind. I mean, we waited 9 months, probably longer, and we're more patient than what we should have been on this. And back in June, I sent Dr. Fauci a personal email to his account, putting him on notice that his agency was in violation of federal sunshine laws regarding his employment documents. So he knew as well.
Once you receive the documents, if and when you receive the documents, will you open source those? What'll happen?
Yeah, we're a transparency organization at OpenTheBooks.com. So everybody listening to the program, come to our website, sign up for our emails, become a part of the organization, and we'll keep you updated in real time, and you'll have first access to the documents once we get them.
OpenTheBooks.com. Adam Andrzejewski, CEO and founder. Appreciate your work and your time today. Thank you.
Are you concerned about equality and fair treatment for African Americans? Do you believe in a future where our communities are safe from both crime and over-policing? President Biden's administration is making major decisions, and we need your voice to be heard. The proposed ban on menthol cigarettes is in its final stages of approval, and Black and brown law enforcement executives have said it could have dire unintended consequences for African Americans. The clock is ticking. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414 and ask him to stop this proposed menthol rule. The ban on menthol could lead to an illicit market and increased crime in our communities. Call President Biden and demand that he halt the ban on menthol until there's a review of the investigative findings. Let's make sure that over-policing and racial profiling come to an end. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414. Tell him to stop targeting African Americans with a menthol ban. Time is running out. This message is paid for by Alliance for Fair and Equitable Policy.
Thank you, Richard.
All right, we'll talk a little Leafs. We'll talk a little Mississauga Steelheads with the voice of the Steelheads, Matt Cullen. He's next on The Richard Serrett Show. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Richard Serrett Show on Newstalk Saga, 960 AM.
Matt Cullen is the voice of the Mississauga Steelheads, heard exclusively here on Newstalk 960 AM. Hey, Matt, welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing well today, Richard. How about yourself?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good about the Leafs after a kind of a slow start, and I was a little worried. But what is this now, 4 in a row? And what an emotional roller coaster. I don't know how many of these I can take, but that win in dramatic fashion over the Bolts, Tavares scoring like 41 seconds, I think, left in regulation time after they pulled Campbell for an extra attacker, and then William Nylander, again, overtime heroics. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, against the two-time Stanley Cup champions as well, right? So that'll be certainly a nice win. And I think the last time we talked last week, Richard, we were talking about a four-game losing streak with the Maple Leafs, and now we're talking about a four-game winning streak. So certainly things have turned around nicely for the Maple Leafs. They have got a couple of overtime wins in there as well. But last night, you know, you take 2 points away from a team that was 41 seconds away from a 1-0 shutout. So I think any way you look at it, you have to be pretty happy. And, of course, John Tavares came through with his fourth of the season late. And Marner, who has, of course, had his, you know, ups and downs, I guess we can say, some struggles over this year, set him up. And he's picked up an assist on well. And then those two set up Willie Nylander in overtime for a great shot. That got stuck in the back of the net. That's how hard he put it by Andre Vasilevsky. So, yeah, really a nice win for the Maple Leafs. And you know, I think it's a little early to be looking at the standings, but you know, there's one undefeated team in the Atlantic, and that's Florida when it comes to losses and regulations. So they're up top, and guess who's number two, Richard? It's the Toronto Maple Leafs after 11 games.
It is very early, but we can't help ourselves. We have to celebrate our victories. Let me ask you, people are talking about Jack Campbell early on again, but MVP for the Leafs thus far, would you say?
Well, he was really good last night, and he was really good. There was another game that stood out to me as well, and that was the game, the overtime win in Chicago. You know, he didn't face a ton of shots last night, only faced 25 shots, but for the save that he had to make, there were some good ones there for sure. Now, the question for me for Jack Campbell was, how was he going to adapt into a starter's role, right? He'd never really been a full-time starter. He played half of the shortened season last year when Frederik Andersen went down. But, you know, he's a guy that's been in the NHL for a number of years, but he's never really grabbed a hold of the starter's role. And I think that we're learning a lot more about goalies, you know, as we go along. Like, you know, some goalies don't take a while to really mature and realize their potential. And Jack Campbell's a great example. Great example of that. He's certainly playing well right now. And the question will be, you know, can he stay healthy? He's 29 years old now. You know, so far that's looked okay. But remember last year, there was a couple of bumps in the road as well where, you know, Michael Hutchinson, the third string goaltender, was getting some games there. So, you know, I really think you have to like his game so far. I mean, the goals against average of 186, the save percentage of 932, a shutout, you know, those are some elite numbers. I don't think that's sustainable over the course of the season, but, you know, you have to like what you're getting from the goalie so far.
You talked about the adjustment that needs to be made moving from a backup goalie to the starting goalie. Is that more of a mental adjustment or a physical adjustment?
You know, that's a great question, you know, and I only think that Jack would have the answer to that, although I will wager a guess for you here, Richard, and I'm going to guess it's a little bit of both. Take the safe answer on that, but I think there's probably a little more emphasis on the physical, just because you're now playing, you know, night in, night out. Sometimes you're playing in back-to-back situations, and you're playing every second night pretty well on the majority of the bases. Now, I do think the goaltending position and the way they divide up the games, that's changed a little bit over the last couple of years. I think, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, you'd maybe see a guy that plays 70 games, like a Marty Brodeur or one of those elite goaltenders, Patrick Waugh, et cetera. You know, now I don't think you can play your goaltender over 60, 65 games out of the 82-game season. I just think there's not enough left in the playoffs. I think we saw that with Frederik Andersen, by the way, who's had an amazing start to the year in Carolina. He's certainly playing with something to prove. But I do think that to be a starting goaltender, it has to be, you have to balance yourself physically. And also, of course, it's mentally, it's about how to keep consistent, not get too high, not get too low. You know, we hear a lot of those different cliches, but I really think that's important when you're fighting the puck. How do you get out of it, and how do you get out of it pretty quickly?
All right, the Leafs meet the Bruins on Sunday. Now, again, early, but as of today, the Bruins find themselves dead last in the Atlantic. However, I believe they have three games in hand. What are you looking for from the Leafs against Boston?
Yeah, I mean, it's a home game for Toronto, so that's a good thing, because looking at Boston's record so far, they've won all four games at TD Garden in Boston, but they've only won one out of the four on the road. So there's a bit of an imbalance there in their schedule. But Boston's a team that's always, you know, no matter what, you know, who's coaching, who's on the ice, they're always going to play the Maple Leafs hard. And, you know, Boston's had Toronto's number over the last couple of years when it comes to those playoffs and those heartbreaking defeats for the Maple Leafs. But I do think that, you know, this is definitely a winnable game for Boston. I mean, Patrice Bergeron scored four goals the other night in a 5-1 win over the Red Wings. So I think, you know, he's of course going to be a factor. Marchand is going to be a factor. You know, but I do think that this is a game for the Maple Leafs, but with the way that they're going, they've won four in a row. I think it's there for the taking, but Saturday night, hockey night in Canada, you never really know what can happen.
Matt, when we come back, we'll talk Steelheads. Back with more of my conversation with the voice of the Steelheads, Matt Cullen, right here on The Richard Serrett Show. Stay with us.
Back to the conversation on The Richard Serrett Show. News Talk, Saga, 960 AM.
Matt Cullen stays with us, the voice of the Mississauga Steelheads. Matt, let's talk about the early play of Steelheads captain Ethan Del Mastro.
Well, yes, he's with the year off last year. I mean, some of these players have really matured, Richard, and Ethan Del Mastro certainly has to be one of them. He was taken by the Chicago Blackhawks in the NHL draft just this past summer in the fourth round. So clearly they saw something in Del Mastro that they liked. Now, for a young guy, I remember two seasons ago, he was playing in the top four already as a rookie for the Mississauga Steelheads and was playing some big minutes and big moments, last couple of minutes of a game, one goal game, tie game into overtime. So he was already playing some big minutes, but I really think that he's taken a nice step forward this year. He's gotten some international experience. He was part of the Canadian gold medal winning team at the under 18 World Championships that were played during the pandemic in Texas. So some international experience, the chance to play against the best in the world in his age group. And I think he's a great captain. I think he has all the right personality traits, all the right character traits to be the Steelheads captain. Now, one thing, Richard, that he did not do, all that he accomplished in the OHL in the rookie season, he did not score a goal. Well, he scored two goals now, and he scored one of them as the overtime winner with less than a second to go in the overtime period in Kingston. If you hadn't had a chance to check that one out, the OHL website has got the highlights of the game. A big win for the Steelheads to grab 2 points against the Kingston team that's expected to be one of the better teams in the East with, you know, if you're following the NHL draft along at all, you know, Shane Wright is at the very top of the list. He plays for Kingston. So that's a great team with an elite-level player that's probably going to make a jump into the NHL right next year, and the Steelheads got him with a 3-2 win.
We talked about James Hardy last week. I was reading where he said that the fact that he got passed over by a couple of NHL teams, he's really using that as his motivation. What does he need to work on?
Yeah, well, what he needs to work on, Richard, is not goal scoring. It's his play away from the puck. He's off to a great start this year with regards to putting the puck in the back of the net. But I talked to James Richmond, the head coach and GM, extensively about this, and he believes that when it comes to Hardy, it's a play away from the puck. How can he be a factor in the defensive zone, whether it's blocking a shot, making sure he's in the right position, making sure he's getting the puck out, making a play away from the puck in the neutral zone? How can he make others better around him? So how can he improve his foot speed? How can he be a quicker first step towards a puck? Those are the kinds of things. How can he set somebody up for success? Those are the kind of things that not only James Richmond and the Steelheads want to see, it's what NHL clubs want to see. Because, you know, when a player scores 34 goals in that short season there, I believe it was 54 games, a lot of the times that player is going to get picked for the NHL draft. So the fact that he didn't was certainly a big surprise, was very disappointing for him. I know that we've talked about that, but I do think that there's a lot of hope for him with regards to he knows what he needs to do to be better. And I talked to James Richmond, as I mentioned last time, we talked quite a bit, and he mentioned that he wants to be like Owen Tippett, who was a former Steelhead star, is now with the Florida Panthers, got taken in the first round. And what Owen did was he needed also to work on his game away from the puck, because as a rookie, or if you're in your first year or second year in the NHL, you're not going to be the guy getting the first line power play minutes. You're not even going to be the guy on the second line getting the power play minutes. You're going to be the guy filling out the bottom, the third and fourth line, making a play, making sure you're tight defensively, making sure you're playing well away from the puck. And yeah, maybe you'll chip in for if you can hit double digits, you know, that's a success in his first year. So I think that's where NHL teams didn't see a fit for him, just because they needed a young player that's going to grow into a role. And I think that's what Hardy needs to do. And he knows that. And working on that, I've seen some improvements already. And the good thing is he still knows how to put the puck in the back of the net. He's off to a great start this year.
You know, Matt, speaking about playing without the puck, that's an element of my game I always prided myself on going back, you know, 40 years ago when I played Church League, because I got so much practice at playing without the puck.
Well, listen, you know, there's two sorts of battles, though, Richard. You know, I'm sure that you were a real character guy on the team, and you know, you were responsible in your own end.
That's right. I was great in the dressing room, not so much
that's
on the bench.
Yeah.
Looking ahead, we've got home and home against Hamilton, tonight against Hamilton, and then Sunday against Niagara. This is kind of a tale of two cities. We've got Hamilton playing well thus far, second place, and Niagara dead last. So what do you expect? What do you look forward to seeing tonight and Sunday?
Well, it's very tight in the Eastern Conference, and there's also a bit of an uneven playing field with regards to how many games have been played so far. Some teams have played 12 games, and the Steelheads have only played 9 games, the fewest in the Eastern Conference. But very, very close in the standings. North Bay Battalion, they lead the way with 7 wins. And the Niagara Ice Dogs, you just mentioned in last place, they have 4 wins. So really, between 1 to 10, Really, there's only three wins that separate the top and the bottom. So Niagara is going to be tough. We'll talk about them in just a second. But Hamilton's a team that the Steel has played already twice this year, and both of them have been close. The first one was a loss, and then the second one was a shootout win for the Steelheads in Hamilton. It was actually just last Saturday afternoon. And they'll be looking to try and win another game against the Bulldogs, and they're a top team. They've got some excellent players. Jan Misak, if you're able to catch the game tonight on right here on News Talk Saga 960 AM, he's a guy that's going to we're going to be hearing from him a lot. NHL prospect. So Hamilton's going to be a good team. There's not really much of a doubt about that. They have 6 wins in the 10 games so far. They have points in 7 of 10. So they're going to give the Steelhead some problems, and I'm sure they didn't appreciate losing in a shootout the other day. So I'm expecting a close game again tonight. And, you know, the Steelheads, again, will have to be very, very careful on the defensive end with Hamilton's top players, but they'll also have to be able to try and beat their goalies. And Marco Costantini, if he plays tonight, he was really good in that game Saturday afternoon.
All right, Niagara.
But yeah, the Niagara Ice Dogs, the team that Mississauga has already seen a couple times this year as well. In fact, it was down at the Meridian Center in Niagara, and it was a 4-2 loss there as well. So the Steelheads will have something to prove here. So this is a team that's had some struggles right now. They've lost 3 in a row, but again, they have a lot of veterans on their team. They have Tucker Tynan in net, and you might remember Tucker Tynan's name. He unfortunately had that very serious injury when his skate caught him as he was making a save, and he had to be immediately rushed to the hospital. There was blood all over the ice, and he very easily could have lost his life if it wasn't for the great work of the first responders. So he took about a year off to recover, back with Niagara this year. So really nice comeback story for Tucker Tynan, and he's a guy that's got NHL aspirations. I think he's a good goaltender considering what he's been through. It's really remarkable that he's back playing hockey again. Talk about mental toughness there, Richard, because you know, I'm sure that must have left a scar, not only physically but emotionally, going through that experience. So that's going to be another one we'll have for you on News Talk Saga 960 AM. And of course, the Sunday games are afternoon games, and the Steelheads will hope to make it a 2-2 weekend here with points against both the Bulldogs and the Ice Dogs.
All right, Matt, I'll let you rest up, get your voice all ready to go. A big game tonight against the Bulldogs, again, right here on Saga 960. We'll talk again soon, I hope. Be well, my friend.
All right, same to you. Have a great weekend.
Matt Cullen.
First we filled your mind. Now, let's twist it. This is The Limb Riddler.
Hey, it's one of the best parts of Friday, a visit from The Limb Riddler with this week's Limb Riddle. Hey, Limb Riddler.
How you doing, Richard? Happy Friday.
Yeah, happy Friday. What do you got for us?
Well, today's Limb Riddle is called Bop on the Noggin.
Ooh.
As usual, you're trying to solve for one word. Today's Limb Riddle actually has 5 clues in it, so no excuses for anybody. It's always easiest to answer these if you can follow along by reading it with me. And to do that, you just have to go to limriddles.com and go to the homepage, and you'll see what I'm seeing right now.
All right, let's have it.
Bop on the Noggin goes like this. While jibing, it might give your noggin a bop. When market activities surge to the top, log drives kept bound, sonic speed sound, an oversized box packed with 80s hip-hop.
Wow, you've done it again. That's a great one. All right. Make sure to send your answer to info@limriddles.com. info@limriddles.com. Be sure to put 960 in the subject line. That way we know you heard it right here on Saga 960 and the Richard Serrett Show. And then be listening just before the news at 6 when I reveal the answer to this week's Limb Riddle and announce the winner of a pair of tickets to the next home game of the Mississauga Steelheads happening this Sunday, November 7th at the Paramount Fine Food Center. All right, Limb Riddler, you have a great weekend and we'll talk again next week.
You too, Richard. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
The Limb Riddler.
Solve this puzzle, The Limb Riddler, every Friday at 4:50 on The Richard Serrett Show on Saga 960 AM.
Hey, don't go away. There's plenty more show to come. Hour 2 of The Richard Serrett Show starts in mere minutes. Jonathan Emord, an American constitutional lawyer and the author of The Authoritarians, joins me for the entire hour. Stay with us.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of Saga 960 AM or its management.
Hey, Richard!
Hello, yes. Can I help you?
Richard!
The Richard Serrett Show continues on Newstalk Saga 960 AM.
Welcome back. Hour 2 of the Richard Serrett Show off and running for Friday, November the 5th. My guest is going to discuss the state of individual freedoms in America. At its core, constitutional lawyer Jonathan Emord says power today is being exercised by something called the administrative state.
Are you concerned about equality and fair treatment for African Americans? Do you believe in a future where our communities are safe from both crime and over-policing? President Biden's administration is making major decisions, and we need your voice to be heard. The proposed ban on menthol cigarettes is in its final stages of approval, and black and brown law enforcement executives have said it could have dire unintended consequences for African Americans. The clock is ticking. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414 and ask him to stop this proposed menthol rule. The ban on menthol could lead to an illicit market and increased crime in our communities. Call President Biden and demand that he halt the ban on menthol until there's a review of the investigative findings. Let's make sure that over-policing and racial profiling come to an end. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414. Tell him to stop targeting African Americans with a menthol ban. Time is running out. This message is paid for by Alliance for Fair and Equitable Policy,
which is a product of authoritarian socialist ideology, which he credits to the 19th century German philosopher Hegel. His new book is called The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th century to the present. In other words, how did we get to where we're at? Jonathan W. Emord has been practicing constitutional and administrative law before the federal courts and agencies since 1985. In fact, I believe he's the only lawyer in U.S. history to defeat.
Are you concerned about equality and fair treatment for African Americans? Do you believe in a future where our communities are safe from both crime and over-policing? President Biden's administration is making major decisions, and we need your voice to be heard. The proposed ban on menthol cigarettes is in its final stages of approval, and black and brown law enforcement executives have said it could have dire unintended consequences for African Americans. The clock is ticking. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414 and ask him to stop this proposed menthol rule. The ban on menthol could lead to an illicit market and increased crime in our communities. Call President Biden and demand that he halt the ban on menthol until there's a review of the investigative findings. Let's make sure that over-policing and racial profiling come to an end. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414. Tell him to stop targeting African Americans with a menthol ban. Time is running out. This message is paid for by Alliance for Fair and Equitable Policy.
The FDA, in court, something like 8 times. Having begun his career as an attorney in the Federal Communications Commission during the administration of President Ronald Reagan, Emord has maintained an abiding conviction to achieve full First Amendment protection for the freedoms of speech and press. Previously, Jonathan has authored Global Censorship of Health Information. Now, that book came out back in 2010, but wow, that's really timely, I would say. The Rise of Tyranny and Restore the Public. Jonathan Emord, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Just fine. Good to be with you again, Richard. How are you?
Very well. Thick book, like 500 pages. We're just going to scratch the surface, obviously. So let's talk about the roots of authoritarianism or socialism in America. And you say it goes back to pre-antebellum South. Let's dive in right there. When and how did socialism take root in pre-antebellum South?
In the 1830s, the Southerners, who were principally responsible for defending the institution of slavery, were under tremendous attack, and it only increased in its ferocity from abolitionists in the North. And they were vexed by the power of the arguments being made by abolitionists. Abolitionists were criticizing Southerners for not only the lack of morality associated with slavery, that is, its immorality, but also they were criticizing them because they had violated the fundamental precepts of the Declaration of Independence, not least of which is all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the governments were instituted among men to protect those rights. So the abolitionists were taking the position that Southerners were violating that most basic charter of the American Republic, and that they were disgracing their ancestors who had fought in the American Revolution. And so in response to that, a number of Southerners then began to question whether they should continue to respect Thomas Jefferson and the Declaration or reject it. And it became a popular rallying cry that they rejected, finding that it's a fiction that all men are created equal. Clearly, all men are not created equal, they argued, and that Thomas Jefferson's position was bunk, and that the Declaration is based on a falsehood. And they then advanced the idea, based on Hegelian socialism. Friedrich Hegel was the architect of collectivism, and his philosophy was well known to the Southerners, and they adopted it directly, overtly, and even proclaimed socialism to be what they were defending. In fact, if you take a look at what Edmund Ruffin, who is a prominent Virginian, he's in fact the one who said that he lied about this, but he said that he was the one to fire the first shot at Fort Sumter commencing the Civil War. That was not true. But he had said that, along with George Fitzhugh, that the institution of slavery, that is plantation slavery, was the beau ideal of socialism. Actually, Fitzhugh went farther. He said it was the beau ideal of communism. And so that's the origin of this intellectual construct within the United States. Socialism had its root right there in the 1830s.
So that's going to come as a huge shock to many people. You're saying that slavery actually is a socialist idea.
It is very much so. And in fact, Friedrich Hegel justified slavery in his construct of collectivism. That's why the Southerners adopted it. Hegel had said that slavery was merely a reflection of the fact that a superior race had defeated or would be defeating an inferior race, and that throughout history, whenever a superior race defeated an inferior race, the inferior race was most frequently enslaved. He said this is not a bad thing. He said it's actually good for both parties.
That's interesting, because we often hear from people that, oh, that's colonialism. We have to tear this statue down and that statue down because they were colonialists, and that the history of vanquished peoples is seen through that lens. The colonialists are part of the British Empire, and that gets tied in with free markets and capitalism. So what you're saying is a complete departure from that.
Yeah, in fact, lies are the currency of the Marxist. And so what you find is that they rewrite history. And that was what Hegel actually did. And not only that, Woodrow Wilson, for example, is a strong Hegelian, a socialist by his own admission in his own writings. And you find that this adoption in the progressive era of socialism, again, is a falsehood. It's based on a phony conception that somehow enslaving yourself to the state, which is socialism, is preferable to free labor, that is, capitalism. That an individual is in a worse state when that individual has freedom of choice among employers than that individual is when control cradle to grave by the state. So the falsehood is that somehow socialism is liberating, and that it's liberating labor. The actual circumstance is that socialism everywhere imposed enslaves labor, because the employer is the government, and the government sets by law the terms for employment and uses a bureaucracy to determine who gets employed, under what circumstances, and their wages, and so on. There's no freedom in that at all. That's entirely giving a monopoly to the state.
Right.
So we
so
are
this idea
far
that
better off. And by the way, this debate went raged between Abraham Lincoln, believe it or not, who defended free labor, and John C. Calhoun and others in the South who defended what they called the mudsill theory, which was that there had to be a class that is kept doing the most menial labor in order for another class to excel, that is, to live at a higher standard of living, and that this was necessary for the progress of humanity. Again, in socialism, we look at collectivism. We look at the collective. It's a hypothetical. We don't know what a body of people believe. Body of people don't believe anything. But there's right. ascribed beliefs by the socialist.
Right. It's like a forest. There's no such thing as a forest. There's only individual
correct.
Trees.
Right. And when you talk about rights, they have to be individual rights. If you talk about collective rights, it's a fiction. And what happens is the socialist tries to confuse the public into thinking that there are such things as collective rights. And what they merely do is define policies and ascribe to them rights if you follow the state, do what the state wants you to do. Everything else is prohibited. Well, that's not individual liberty. That's not individual protection of rights. That's slavery and denial of individual rights.
So the rulers in the state, those that believe that they are intellectually superior to those that they are ruling over, and this is justified because the conqueror must be superior to the vanquished, otherwise they wouldn't have been successful in conquering them. This sounds like social Darwinism, but didn't Hegel predate Darwin?
Yes, but it fits in quite nicely with social Darwinism, and that's in fact a catalyst, as I explain in the book. It is a catalyst, actually, to the progressive era and the progressive movement. What happened was, although the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, it didn't abolish socialist thinking, not by a long shot. And in fact, socialist thinking then led academics into the notion that you could create a government outside the Constitution's limits and outside of the concept of individual liberty that is inherent in the United States Constitution through the administrative state. Now, if you followed the framers' construct, for example, if we take George Washington's words, let there be no change by usurpation, for though in one instance it may be an instrument of good, it is the customary weapon by which free governments are destroyed. And by that he meant that we may not change the Constitution without an amendment. Why? Because of the language in the Declaration. That is, just governments are predicated on the consent of the governed. Well, the people of the United States, through the ratification process, through their representatives, consented to the language of the Constitution and the powers invested in the three branches and the limitations on those powers and the protection of rights. Well, if you change that construct, you have to proceed by amendment, again seeking the consent of the governed, because in Lockean terms, under the Second Treatise on Government, John Locke made this express, that if you rule without consent, you have no legitimacy, and it's merely tyranny. So you can impose your will and without limitation. And that's what happened with the administrative state. Although it, under following the Constitution, they would have had to, under Article 5, sought a constitutional amendment and achieved it, they instead had a major power grab in which they created the administrative state for the very express purpose, when you read their writings, the express purpose of avoiding the limitations on power in the Constitution, the separation of powers, and the checks and balances of the Constitution. And so they achieved that magnificently, grossly, in the administrative state, which has combined legislative, executive, and judicial power, which James Madison defined as the very definition of tyranny.
All right, stay put, Jonathan. We'll take a quick timeout, come back, and continue our discussion of the authoritarians. Stay with us.
Welcome back to the Richard Serrett Show on News Talk, Saga 960 AM.
Jonathan W. Emord, my guest, constitutional lawyer. The book is The Authoritarians. Now, let's just back up just a bit, because when we're talking about the administrative state, we have to find out how we got to that point, because you point out that after the Civil War, you had all of these intellectuals that wanted to become university professors, influencers, obviously, in charge of young minds. And so they went to Germany, Hegel's home, where Hegel had set up all of these schools. So when these American academics, intellectuals, went to Germany and studied in Hegel's school, what did they learn? And then what did they bring back?
From the period roughly the 1860s forward, hundreds of academics from the United States flocked to Germany. Germany was considered to be, in academia at the time, an ideal construct of education in the graduate level, because they created what we have adopted as the method for graduate education. And scholars from all of the major universities in the United States went to Germany and studied under professors who taught in the historic schools, they were called, the Hegelian concept of collectivism. And that teaching denounced expressly the American Constitution, the American Declaration of Independence, the notion, Lockean notion of rights, that individual rights exist, that the governments are instituted to protect those rights, and declared that to be rubbish, saying that actually individuals never have rights, that it's always the collective that has rights, that rights come from the state, not from God. The notion of the Founding Fathers was that rights are bequests that are given to each individual at birth and are unalienable, cannot be taken away by the state. The Hegelians taught that the greatest virtue for an individual was to pursue the policy directions set by the state, and that it was not to be set by democratic institutions, but rather was to be set by experts in an administrative state who could best discern what was in the quote-unquote common good.
A technocracy.
Yes, an oligarchy of experts. That's what they said needed to exist. And so they established the benefits arising from the administrative state to be efficiency and to be advancement, progress, beyond that which was ever possible by the cumbersome, slow constitutional process of a republic. And so they trained these academics to denounce or hate their own government, the Republic of the United States. They came back and fulfilled the wishes of their professors in Germany by building an academia that was dedicated to the same thing, denouncing the Constitution, advocating changes that would result in a loss of constitutional governance and an increase in autocratic or authoritarian power through the administrative state, which would have combined legislative, executive, and judicial powers, and would pursue the common interest defined by eggheads, individuals who are said to be academically superior to common people.
This is fascinating because many of us sit back and we think, well, this revolution, this cultural revolution started in the 1960s, but actually it started maybe in the 1860s, the late 1860s.
That's correct. It very much did. And by 1881, we had our first federal bureaucracy in the Interstate Commerce Commission preceding 1881, from 1860 to 1880. Numerous independent regulatory commissions were established at the state level by individuals who were avowed socialists, governors who were socialists, and by academics who were socialists. Socialism became very popular at this time in academia, and it was along the Hegelian model. It's noteworthy that Karl Marx was a student of Hegel's and was a dedicated student of Hegel. He just took Hegelian socialism farther, to a more brutal communism, but nonetheless, it's a slippery slope. Once you're on that socialist slide, you end up with communism because invariably power just aggregates. Power unchecked simply grows. And
right,
the ultimate
right. What's that? Is it Ayn Rand who said, communism is murder, socialism is suicide? We're going to take a time out, Jonathan, when we come back. So we're getting into this, the beginning, the very early stages of the progressive era. The beginning of the administrative state. And of course, then under, you know, about 50 years later, that is accelerated under FDR. And in the authoritarians you list, I think there are three pages just listing all of the federal agencies, dozens and dozens and dozens of federal agencies created by FDR. who was a great admirer of Mussolini. They had kind of this mutual admiration society going on. Remember, Mussolini, the fascist, FDR, wanted to send representatives over to study this wonderful progressive Mussolini character. We'll come back. Jonathan W. Emord.
Back with more of The Richard Serrett Show right after these.
The Bull Session continues on The Richard Serrett Show. News Talk, Saga 960 AM.
Constitutional lawyer Jonathan Emord, my guest. His book is The Authoritarians.
Let's bring it up to the 1930s, FDR, the New Deal, the creation of dozens and dozens and dozens of federal agencies. The idea is that they are now circumventing Congress. They are making law. What percentage of law is, or let's say under FDR, was being made by federal agencies rather than by Congress and the president?
So 2 years into the New Deal, we have the NRA, the National Recovery Administration, and also we have total government control over agriculture. The NRA controlled every aspect of production, of pricing for products, and of supply and distribution. In other words, it was total government control along that fascist Mussolini type of model. And when you ask the question then, what percentage of law, well, even though the regulatory state was nascent, it was nonetheless expansive and extensive, so much so that every aspect of commerce was controlled by the federal government in the first New Deal, and then less so after the Supreme Court struck down the New Deal. But the second New Deal reintroduced redistribution of income as a primary means, but also several agencies continued under one form or another. The NRA was ultimately rejected because it was an utter disaster. But you could reasonably say that at a minimum, more than half of all federal law at that time was the result of the administrative state, not the Congress of the United States, not the elected representatives of the people. Now, fast forward to the present, and it is easily over three-quarters of all federal law is the product of the unelected heads of the administrative agencies, not those we elect. In other words,
75%.
The administrative state is the true government of the United States.
Right. So when President Trump was busy deregulating, and we saw those huge, it was a wonderful visual, those huge stacks of paper, and you know, look, we cut 12 million regulations today. That was a direct attack on the administrative state. Some people call it the deep state, but let's use the term administrative state. That must have been a huge, huge threat to them.
Yes, but what we found in the Reagan administration, if you simply deregulate, then when socialists get back in power, or even when they don't, when less aggressive presidents who are conservative are in power, the administrative state regrows and reestablishes its original control and expands beyond it. In other words, it's an ever-growing, gargantuan machine. In the end, the only solution for us, if we are to have individual liberty and protection for rights and to recognize the sovereignty of the individual, as was the very purpose of the Constitution of the United States, you have to get rid of the administrative state because it is illegitimate from the get-go. The transfer of power under Article 1, for example, of the Constitution, all legislative power is invested in the Congress of the United States. Not some, all. And
right.
Only the Congress of the United States has constitutional authority to create law. And yet the administrative state creates law and does it unconstitutionally in violation of the vesting clause, it's called, of Article 1. The same is true with respect to the Article 3 power, which is exclusive to the judiciary, and I would argue the same is true for the executive power. So the administrative state actually entirely defeats the Constitution, because if you're caught up in it, if you're the accused, all of your rights are taken from you. You have
right. I wanted to ask you about that, Jonathan. So you run afoul of the EPA, let's say. Do they have to have a warrant?
They are allowed to use what is, in fact, a general warrant. Now, a general warrant is issued by an executive magistrate, not by a judge, and it can ask for anything. And so general warrants in England were used by the courts of Star Chamber and High Commission from about the 14th century forward until the 17th century. And they were despised by the people because a magistrate working essentially as a surrogate for the crown could go after an enemy of the crown and obtain all of their information, rifle through all of their files, all of their papers, and gather up witnesses and so forth, and then haul the person before the Court of Star Chamber or High Commission, and they would have to answer for any number of accusations without any advance notice and without having an independent judiciary decide the propriety of the search in the first place, the probable cause that would justify it. What crime has this man or this woman committed? And so while the Founding Fathers prohibit in the Constitution use of general warrants, they have come alive again in the administrative state, which uses general warrants routinely in the United States, and the hapless person who is accused has no choice but to turn over all of these documents.
Do you have a right to face your accuser?
There's no right to know who your accuser is. So when the administrative state attacks you, you don't know who's responsible for the charge. Not only that, you're essentially guilty until you've proven yourself innocent, reversing the constitutional presumptions. And furthermore, you have no right to a jury trial. The party that is prosecuting you is also the judge, and in that there can be no justice at all. You're always guilty.
Unbelievable. And, what's their conviction rate?
Well, it's 100%. The only instance where it deviates, and they're very rare, is when the administrative state itself decides what it has done is wrong, and that's a very rare circumstance.
All right, Jonathan, stay put. Back in 3 minutes.
Just having a little chin wag on The Richard Serrett Show. News Talk, Saga 960 AM.
Welcome back. So, America is ruled by an administrative state. They produce 75% of the law, not the Congress, not the president enacting the law. It is this administrative state or the deep state, unelected, unaccountable. These federal agencies that are running the country, they have their own court system, star chambers, where the accused is guilty until proven innocent. They have a 100% conviction rate. You don't have a right to face your accuser. All the major tenets of the judicial system, supposedly, are thrown out the window. And to add to this, Jonathan, you know, a lot of younger people are disenchanted with capitalism, and they say, well, it's the rich ruling over the poor, and the dividing wage, you know, the dividing income gap, and all of these things. They blame capitalism, but it's really the inequities that are produced by this corporatist state that we now have. Talk to me about how the corporatist state emerged and the role of something called favored enterprises.
Well, in this time period of the progressive era, actually immediately after the Civil War with the rise of industrialization in the United States, we have huge demographic shifts that are taking place with people moving from rural areas into the cities, exactly the opposite of what's happening now. And you have much considerable social change, too, with large influx of immigrants coming from Europe, and it was very unsettling for elites, for those who had been accustomed to being a ruling class in these urban areas before the influx of all these changes, and they had also been economically superior people because they had lived at the top of an agrarian, largely agrarian society. Now, with capitalism, you have a rush of people who were poor coming into the middle class. In fact, during this period, we have the largest increase in economic wealth among people in the history of the world in the United States taking place with a burgeoning middle class and with people for the first time achieving magnificent wealth. And it was oftentimes rags to riches and then back to rags again, but it was rags to riches. And it was an upwardly mobile, very dynamic capitalist environment. Well, that's a very uncomfortable environment, not only for the elites, but also for captains of industry who suddenly realize that without consolidation of industry to the extent that they can monopolize, they are liable to lose, that is, go from riches to rags, because of innovation coming into the market. And so you have all of these magnates trying to create monopolies. Now, what Gabriel Kolko, brilliant economist, and Murray Rothbard, another brilliant economist, really definitively have shown, and there are many, many now who chime in the world of economics on this point, they were never successful in producing monopolies in the marketplace. The only way they achieved it was through government intervention. So, for example, the Granger movement was essentially a movement by farmers, particularly poor farmers, to get government help to set, to fix the rates of rail transportation so that they could afford to move grain. Now, the reality was they could afford to move grain, and there was quite a bit of competition among the rails using a rebate system. But what the Grangers wanted to do was basically produce even lower rates to their advantage. And what happened was the government stepped in, purportedly on behalf of the Grangers, but then rapidly became influenced, lobbied by the railroad magnates who were able to pump money into campaigns and heavily control political fortunes. And they succeeded in taking, co-opting the populist movement for rate setting, and they set rates at monopoly levels, and they had anti-rebate laws which eliminated their competition, that is, new entrants, and they secured monopoly control through a combination with the government. This then happens over again and again and again in various industries, even the communications industry by the 1930s, actually the late 1920s. So,
right. Excuse me, Jonathan. This is a short segment. We're going to take a break. This was just a short 6-minute segment. We'll come back and pick up on this in a moment. But and today, of course, we're seeing this favored enterprise with big tech, with big pharma. Elon Musk, I suppose you could argue, has benefited greatly from this. But people blame capitalism for these huge income disparities and so forth, and wealth disparities between the very, very rich and the very, very poor. But in fact, it's not capitalism and free markets to blame. It's corporatist America and this favored enterprise system, which is fascism, really.
Yeah.
We'll pick up on that.
For the corporate class.
Right. We'll pick up on this on the other side. Jonathan E. Mord, The Authoritarian.
Let's rejoin the conversation on The Richard Serrett Show on News Talk, Saga 960 AM.
A few minutes remain with Jonathan E. Mord, U.S. constitutional lawyer, author of The Authoritarians. I want to get back to the corporate state and favored enterprises. Let's look at the Green New Deal as an example, where the government decides to pick winners and losers in the energy field.
They're basically telling consumers, we don't care that you want cheap oil and gas to run your vehicles and heat your homes, and that you want reliable energy. We are deciding for you that you will have unreliable, intermittent energy, solar and wind. I don't understand at the top why they would want to destroy the golden goose. Why are they doing this? Is this about a wealth transfer to China? What's going on here?
Well, it's about control. It's about acquiring power over the most significant industry in the country. That is the backbone, the very backbone of the economy, the fossil fuel economy. So if you can obliterate fossil fuels and compel people to rely on intermittent and unreliable sources like solar and wind, then you have achieved that degree of control over people, and you've rendered them helpless, essentially, because you destroy the capitalist system by doing this. You absolutely do. And take a look at California, how reliable their energy system is as they progressively move in this direction in advance of the federal effort nationally. It's not a hidden enterprise, actually. AOC, her chief of staff, was communicating with a governor, governor's assistants on climate change early on in this process of developing this Green New Deal proposal. And he laughed at them when they were talking about this as an environmental measure because he said, no, we're doing this in order to bring about socialism. What he's effectively saying is that this is a Trojan horse for the delivery of socialism to America. Corporatism, picking winners and losers, destroying the existing system of free enterprise that gives us cheap energy that's very clean, and replacing it with actually what's quite toxic, solar panels and windmills that require vast stretches of an entire real estate equal to entire state to put these bird-killing windmills into operation. So, and bat-killing. It is a lie. First of all, it's a lie that it's an environmentally superior method of energy. Second, it's a lie that it could ever be reliable and could replace on equal terms the energy generated from fossil fuels. And third, it is a lie that people's lives would not be adversely affected. We would be driven into the Stone Age by this this transformation. It would ruin our countries, bring them absolutely down, and invite the communists in China and in Russia to basically rule the world.
So what's in it for, I don't know, the Gavin Newsoms and the AOCs? Do they think that once all of this wealth is transferred to China and China basically takes over, that they will be rewarded somehow?
Well, truth be told, they have no problem with the ideology because they believe in it. Communism is what they really believe in. And they don't have a problem in it because they become the solution to every problem. In other words, once you have a centralized government plan to replace the existing system of energy with this solar energy, and you have planned economies, just like in the Soviet Union, planned economies, then they are in a position of controlling it. They are jealous of power. They would never want to give power away to the Chinese. They want it for themselves, but they want also to destroy all other aspects of the constitutional system. If they could be dictators indefinitely throughout their lives, that's what they would like, and their move is in that direction. It's an inconvenience to have to answer to the American people. They want total control.
Let's talk about some of the solutions. You talk about how people need to, number one, they need to defend their property. They need to go after looters and arsonists and so forth. They need to sue the people that are behind the looters and the arsonists. But doesn't that require the rule of law? Aren't these same elites, haven't they also infiltrated the court system? I mean, the father of this whole progressive era, I think you mentioned, it was a Supreme Court justice. Can you rely on the courts anymore?
Well, of all of the branches of the government, the judiciary has been the least affected by these changes. Without question, there has been, you mentioned that Justice Felix Frankfurter, he was an advocate of the administrative state. He was a socialist, and he advocated the administrative state and administrative law adjudication. But the Article III courts remain the strongest bastions, as do the state courts, even though they have, without a doubt, bad apples in them. The point here is when your police don't provide you with protection, when they have been essentially disabled by this defund the police movement and by elimination of bail and so forth, such that you are simply sitting ducks for criminals because there's no police presence, you have to resort to methods of self-protection, and that means you have to exert protection for your rights through the courts and through self-help, your Second Amendment right to be armed and to protect your property and your lives. And
what about, we just got a couple minutes here, but what about reversing this whole administrative state system? Is it too late?
No. And in fact, we are in a position now uniquely to make some substantial changes. I think for the first time, many Americans are receptive to this message that in the next election in 2022, we're likely to see the House, if not the Senate, turn into hands that are in favor of these kinds of measures. And we have to understand, it's not enough to win the election. We have to dismantle the administrative state. We have to do that if we really mean to be free, if we believe in individual liberty, and if we believe that individuals should be sovereign and that the state should be their servant, not the other way around. We have to take advantage of the election, and it must be beyond simply winning and stopping the bleeding that's going on and the destruction of free enterprise. We have to go beyond that. We have to dismantle the administrative state. That is the answer to taking socialism out of the government.
All right, Jonathan, again, I have to get you back on, and we need more time. This is so important. The authoritarians, their assault on individual liberty, the Constitution, and free enterprise from the 19th century to the present. Jonathan, thank you again. We'll talk soon.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
And now, your Lim Riddler answer and this week's winners.
All right, here's this week's Lim Riddle once again. It's called Bop on the Noggin. While jibbing, it might give your noggin a bop. When market activities surged to the top, log drivers kept bound, sonic speed sound, an oversized box packed with 80s hip-hop. And the answer is, did you get it? Boom. Boom. While jibbing, it might give your noggin a bop. Jibbing, as opposed to coming about, involves turning your sailboat away from the wind. This makes the boom, that's the big horizontal beam on the bottom of the mainsail, come flying across the center of the boat, which could inflict a nasty bop on the head to any sleepy crew members. 90% of sailors admit they've done this. The rest are full of brine. When market activities surge to the top, a boom in a stock or real estate market is characterized by the heightened trading activity and increased prices. Log drives kept bound. Log drives move floating logs downstream from forest to sawmill. A log boom is a barrier placed in the river to contain the logs. Sonic speed sound. Well, a sonic boom is a loud noise caused by the shockwave from an aircraft traveling faster than the speed of sound. And an oversized box packed with 80s hip-hop. The 80s and 90s featured the barely portable boom box, complete with cassette tape player, AM/FM radio, integrated amplifier and speakers. It was a favorite among muscular rockers and hip-hoppers. And congratulations to Christine D. Savita of Stony Creek. You've won a pair of tickets for the Mississauga Steelheads home game on Sunday, November the 7th at 2 p.m. Other honorable mentions go to Amy Luhu of Toronto, Barbara McEwen of Toronto, Paul Kitney of Peterborough, and Trisha Benson from Canberra, Australia. Okay, that's it for me. My thanks to Jody, Jacob, and Brandon. I'll be back on Monday to do it all over again, God willing. The Brian Crombie Hour is next. Don't forget the Steelheads right here on Saga 960 at 7 p.m. Have a great weekend. I'll speak with you Monday at 4. Don't be late. Until then, I remain unbowed, unbent, unbroken.
That's it. That's all. For more Richard Serrett Show, podcasts, blogs, and other stuff, go to saga960am.ca. Stop talking past each other and start talking with each other. We'll see you Monday afternoon at 4 on The Richard Serrett Show on News Talk, Saga 960 AM.
Are you concerned about equality and fair treatment for African Americans? Do you believe in a future where our communities are safe from both crime and overpolicing? President Biden's administration is making major decisions, and we need your voice to be heard. The proposed ban on menthol cigarettes is in its final stages of approval, and Black and brown law enforcement executives have said it could have dire unintended consequences for African Americans. The clock is ticking. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414 and ask him to stop this proposed menthol rule. The ban on menthol could lead to an illicit market and increased crime in our communities. Call President Biden and demand that he halt the ban on menthol until there's a review of the investigative findings. Let's make sure that overpolicing and racial profiling come to an end. Call President Biden at 202-456-1414. Tell him to stop targeting African Americans with a menthol ban. Time is running out. This message is paid for by Alliance for Fair and Equitable Policy.